with Rich Alexander. Weekdays starting at 5:30, KSAL Salina.
Prepare for a true revolution.
Actually, you can't prove God exists.
Questioning tradition, because what you've been taught isn't always true.
The truth will set you free.
The truth will set you free. This is Truth Revolution. I'm Dave, and sitting with me is Jeff.
Good morning, Salina, Kansas.
How are you doing this morning?
I've got a cold, and I'm tired, but I'm excited because we've got some good information this morning.
Do we?
We do. We have a special guest on, someone I've been looking forward to for weeks. Do you know who this is, Dave?
Would that be one Hugh Ross?
That would be a Dr. Hugh Ross. He's on the line with us. Dr. Ross, are you there?
Yes, I am.
It is so good to have you here today. I've been looking forward to this for weeks. We've read your book, your new book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Of course, I've read your books for years now. So allow me to just talk here about how much of a fan I am of you.
Here we go.
I got my master's degree in apologetics, and your books were required reading for my classes. So, you know, this is just a really exciting thing to do here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, absolutely. We are going to be talking with Dr. Hugh Ross, who is an astrophysicist, a biblical scholar, a man of genius, about his new book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Dave, you want to give a little synopsis here of what this book is about?
Well, it's a commentary on the Book of Job.
Essentially, from a very special perspective.
Right.
From the perspective of how does this book help us understand Genesis? How does the Book of Job teach us things about creation and our Creator? Dr. Ross, would you like to add anything to that description?
Well, I believe that Job is the oldest book of the Bible in terms of its content. It gives more science content than any other book of the Bible. It really is a foundation for the rest of the books of the Bible. As you know, it introduces the problem of evil. Mm-hmm. It talks about creation. But, you know, I subtitled the book, How the Oldest Book in the Bible Answers Today's Scientific Questions. What amazes me about Job is how it predicted so many of the latest scientific discoveries that we're uncovering right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, let me just ask a question. You are classically trained as an astronomer. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So why would a scientist write a book about the biblical book of Job? What got you started even looking into that in the first place?
Well, it's always been a favorite book of mine, and I recognize that Job has had more commentaries written on it than any other book of the Bible. But as I looked at those hundreds of commentaries, I noticed none of them addressed the science or the creation issues in the book, which was a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. But that's about half the content of the book. And for me, it really helped solidify my understanding of the other two dozen creation accounts in the Bible. But since someone's got to write a book, uncovering all this science content. And also, as a pastor, I recognize Christians tend to fight a lot over creation. And if you look at Job, it resolves those controversies so beautifully. So I look at it as a peacemaking tool.
Interesting. Now, I was looking at kind of your biography here, and you actually, you were not a Christian, but through your studies in science, you came to believe that reason convinced you of the truth of the Bible. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. I didn't really get to know Christians till I was 27 years of age, but during my childhood years, I became fascinated with astronomy, studied it intensely, and at age 16 became convinced that the Big Bang was the correct explanation for the origin of the universe. And I knew if it was Big Bang, there's a beginning. If there's a beginning, there's a beginner. So that's when I recognized there had to be a God. And starting at age 17, I began to look at different philosophical perspectives, Kant and Descartes, went into the different holy books of the religions of the world, and then after a two-year study, recognized that the Bible alone gave an accurate account of the origin and history of the universe, Earth, and Earth's life, accurately predicted future scientific discoveries, and I signed my name on the back of a Gideon Bible at age 19. When I did research at Caltech, that's where I met Christians for the first time.
Wow, that's amazing. So essentially, it was the cosmological argument that brought you to the reality that God exists, and
right.
Then after study, so you said God exists, and then you started looking, what kind of God was this?
Right. I looked at the God of Hinduism and realized that in Hinduism it taught a cosmology that had already been falsified by modern discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went into the Bible, I also saw in the Bible that it gave a trans-dimensional perspective on God. I didn't see in any other holy book.
Now wait, what do you mean by a trans-dimensional perspective?
Well, the Bible is the only holy book that gives you doctrines or attributes about God that you can't possibly visualize in the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. And as a scientist, I recognize that we humans can only visualize phenomena in the dimensions that we experience. So what that told me is all these other holy books, you know, the Quran, the Vedas, Mormon texts, the Buddhist commentaries, that these were all written with the limitations of human visualization, and they all describe God in a way that could be visualized in the four dimensions we experience. But when I picked up the Bible, it talks about God as a triune being. It talks about eternal security, the simultaneity of human free will and divine predetermination. And I said, this must be from a transcendent source. And the fact that everything it said proved to be true in terms of its history and its science, not only in the past, but what it predicted in the future. And I said, this can only be a book that's been inspired by the one that created the universe. And that's what motivated me to sign my name in a Gideon Bible, giving my life to Christ. I spent 8 years trying to find a church in Canada where I've been raised that believed the same thing I did. I couldn't find one. But when I took up postdoctoral research at Caltech, that's where I met Christians. That's where I found Bible-believing churches. And a church there, within a year, put me on their staff as their minister of evangelism. In fact, they helped me launch Reasons to Believe, the science-based think tank I head up today.
Wow, that's amazing.
That is amazing. My name's Dave. I'm not really a learned guy. I just have gotten all my learning from church and stuff like that. But I'm smiling because, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and it's a lot of the stuff that Pastor Jeff has been teaching over at the church. And you know, I feel like I'm almost in over my head here with listening to you two guys. So
Dave's modest; he knows exactly what's going on here.
But what I want to know is, you know, there are other commentaries on Job out there. How does your book differ from all the others?
Well, it's the only commentary that I'm aware of that really digs into the science content of the book and puts it in a modern-day context. I mean, what amazed me about Job is it answers the science questions of its generation, but it also answers the science questions of our generation. And, you know, 2 years ago, a new science discipline got launched, which was looking at the characteristics of the minds of the higher animals. And that's something that Job deals with in great detail. And it's a profound challenge to the evolutionary paradigm, because you try to build an evolutionary tree based on the capabilities of the minds of the higher animals, it's in complete odds with the one that you would build based on their physical characteristics. I'll give you an example from Job. In chapter 39, it talks about the donkey and the horse, and how the donkey and the horse are physically very similar to one another, but in terms of their mental capabilities, particularly the way they relate to human beings, you couldn't find two opposite animals. Therefore, both must be special creations. They can't be related through some evolutionary paradigm, because there's no way you would say that these characteristics of the mind are related to one another. And then, you know, Job gets into kind of a top 10 list of the animals that God gave us to launch civilization.
Right.
And what I recognize reading that is that without those 10 animals, you can't launch civilization. And the proof of that is when you look at Australia, North America, and South America that lacked those animals, they never got out of the Stone Age.
Now wait a minute. That's a really interesting claim to me, because the 10 animals here in the book of Job, which I think you talked about in chapter 10, you know, is like the lion, the goat, the deer, the wild ox, the dog, those type of animals, right?
Right, right.
And could you say this again? The countries that didn't have those type of animals never launched civilization?
They never got past the Stone Age level of technology. and their civilization really didn't advance over time. But if you look at Europe and Asia and Africa, they were able to advance because they had access to those animals. And Job explains how those animals assist human beings.
That's fascinating. So these particular animals actually played a role in developing our civilization, and the book of Job, which was written long before any other book of the Bible, actually recognizes that fact. That's kind of what you're arguing here, right?
Well, more than that, God gave us those animals to teach us things about Him. Job in chapter 12 says, look to the birds, look to the mammals, and they will teach you. They will instruct you. They will instruct you about God. And, you know, God gave us these animals. They're higher than the other animals on the planet, but they're powerfully motivated to serve and please human beings. And this is what Job 38 and 39 draws out, just how powerfully they're motivated to serve us and to please us. And likewise, God endowed us with a powerful motivation to serve and please Him. But something gets in the way. These 10 animals don't serve and please us as well as they could because of our sin. And so our sin breaks those relationships we have with those animals in the same way that sin breaks our relationship with God. And that's why Job is saying, if you look to these animals, you'll learn deep lessons about yourself, about sin, about your relationship with these animals, how God wanted to reward you, and about your relationship with God. And the thing I've noticed in my 30 years of evangelistic ministry around the world, the atheists live in cities. I've yet to find an atheist that has contact with these animals, significant contact with these animals.
That's interesting.
I've never, ever, ever thought about that.
But it's true.
It is true.
That's awesome. Well, that's a real nice introduction. We're gonna talk to you a little bit more here coming up in a couple minutes. We're going to do a little piece on our program right now about Bible contradictions.
About Bible contradictions.
Bible contradictions.
All right, today's Bible contradiction talks about the different times in which Jesus called his disciples. And
because he called a lot of disciples.
He did.
He had at least 12. Sometimes the Bible refers to like 500.
Right.
But we're talking about specific ones here, I'm thinking.
Yes, we are talking about specific ones. And what we're talking about is, okay, John 1, 37 through 49 is actually quite a long, so follow with me. I mean, this is the main one that kind of sticks out from the rest.
I will track with you.
All right. So it says, when the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you want?" They said, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" "Come," he replied, "and you will see." So they went and saw where he was staying and spent that day with him. It was about the 10th hour. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard that John had said and who had followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We have found the Messiah," and he brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon the son of John, and we will call you Cephas," which is Peter. And the next day Jesus decided to leave Galilee, and finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth, can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asked. "Come and see," said Philip. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said to him, "Here is a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false." "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked.
Okay, and he talked about the tree and all that
right.
sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And so they started following him. Or so it claims here. Well, this is kind of like at odds with other scriptures in the Bible. Matthew 4:18 through 22 and Mark 1:16 through 20 are kind of the same thing, and it basically covers this. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew, and they were casting their net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come and follow me," Jesus said, "and I will make you fishers of men." At once they left their nets and followed him. And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets, and Jesus called them. Immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him.
Okay, so the supposed contradiction is that in the book of John, it says Jesus told these guys to follow him and they followed him. Mm-hmm. But in the book of Matthew, at a much different time, Jesus had followed me and they followed him.
Right. And we're talking that basically he caught them at work. Is what he's saying.
Right.
And then, of course, in Luke, it's one of my favorite passages where basically Jesus had him cast out from the shore, and he taught the people. And then after he was done teaching, he said, go out and cast your nets. And, of course, you know, Peter was like, well, you know, we've been out fishing all night. We haven't caught a thing. And Jesus was like, just do it.
Gotcha.
And they caught so many fish that their nets began to break and their boats began to sink. And that's when, you know, Peter fell to his knees and said, you know, go away from me. I'm a sinful man. And
okay, so the question then is, which one really was the time when they followed Jesus? Was it this time in John, or was it the later time in Matthew, or when was this?
The Bible seems to jump around a lot.
Like it's contradicting itself here. Okay, now, of course, we use a list of like 18 things from Norman Geisler. He's given us 18 mistakes people make when they supposedly find a Bible contradiction.
Right.
I've added a few things to this list. I would like to say mistake number 20 on our list is this. Not reading the Bible. Okay, look.
Just reading selective passages.
Just reading selectively or making assumptions when you read. We didn't really read. We heard this and made assumptions all about the text. In John 1, Jesus is talking to these guys and he says, follow me. There's something missing after that that we don't see in these verses that we see in the book of Matthew. Because in Matthew 4:22, Jesus says, follow me, I will make you fishers of men. And then verse 22, it says, then they followed him. It doesn't say that in John.
Right.
And so what we've got is a possible situation where Jesus called them to follow him that first time. It was like an initial interview. They're like, who is this guy, Jesus? Mm-hmm. And he says, you can follow me. But they did not do anything about it. The second time he says, follow me, and they followed.
Right.
And so we're talking about two different times. Now, look, even if you want to say, well, that's just blasphemy. They followed Jesus their whole life. Like, if that's really passionate to you.
Right.
Just because, even if they did follow him this first time in John, it doesn't mean Jesus didn't reiterate, follow me.
Right.
It's okay for Jesus to say, follow me to these people once or twice or three times.
Just probably did a lot more than that.
Probably. Just because he says, follow me two or three times doesn't mean that the Bible's contradicting itself. It just means this happened more than once.
Right. So, excellent.
That is our Bible contradiction for today.
All right, that was our Bible contradiction. So, we get back to the meat of the program here.
Back to Dr. Hugh Ross. Dr. Ross, I was reading your book here, and one thing that really stuck out, I want to get into some of the meat of this book a little bit, you know, where you talk about the dark matter or hurricanes and all these different things. But one thing that struck me was, in the introduction to your book, you said that friends warned you, no one who attempts to write a book of any kind of commentary on Job can escape without new suffering. And that was true for you too, wasn't it?
Because of the suffering that my family and I went through, it gave me some new perspectives on Job, and I actually changed the outline and changed the way the book did, and recognized that you can actually make a link between the science content and the suffering. So that's kind of what I did in the latter chapters of the book.
Oh, wow. Now, I mean, just to kind of give our listeners a little bit of a glimpse here, you started writing this book, and you had just a few things here in order. A major artery was blocked, and you had, was it a near heart attack?
Well, my widowmaker artery was completely blocked, and, you know, I was actually quite, you know, capable. I was running and everything because I run every day. But when the doctor checked it, he said, you're not going home. We're operating right away.
Oh, my goodness. And then after that, your dad was suddenly diagnosed with mesothelioma and passed
away. Right, he died within 6 weeks. But, you know, I had a wonderful time with him just before he died. Talked about what death is like and, you know, how we're going to meet again. So
wow. And then you contracted asthma.
Contracted asthma, wound up getting cancer. But, you know, the Lord's brought me through all this. The worst part of all was having my older son stabbed so badly he almost died. My wife went through all this, too. But, you know, going through all that, I recognize there's a reason why God designed the science of the universe the way he did. because it allows us to appreciate why God takes us through the suffering, how each law of physics has been designed to deal with the problem of evil. We live in a universe that's perfectly designed to remove evil once and for all. But the suffering we go through is a critical component in God's conquest, rapid and efficient conquest and removal of evil. And we need to realize this universe is not our home. Our eternal home is the new creation. God designed the perfect universe to deal with evil and suffering, and he's going to usher us into a brand new creation. You know, I kind of cover some of that and why the universe is the way it is, but you know, going through that suffering enabled me to put a new link on that in this book on Job.
That's interesting. Now, you talk a little bit in there about, you were just mentioning moral evil, you know, things that happen to us that are morally wrong. And but there's something called natural evil. You know, we talked about moral evil on this show, I think, last week or the week before. But, you know, natural evil, people talk about hurricanes and how deadly they are and how terrible things like that are. And why would God even allow hurricanes to exist? But you kind of address this in your book a little bit.
Yeah, we do, and I really don't like the term natural evil, because when I look at all the things that we call natural evils, hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, droughts, fires, every one of them is optimally designed to make life as good as it can possibly be, given the laws of physics that God chose. Now, you could say, why didn't God choose different laws of physics? But they're the ideal laws, the optimal laws, to bring about a rapid conquest and removal of evil.
So are you saying
given
that...
Given the laws of physics, you're going to have these kinds of things. When we look at hurricanes, for example, they're optimal. If we had less, life would be worse. If we had more, life would be worse. They're optimal in terms of the number and the intensity. So I describe the different ways in the book, for example, how we benefit from hurricanes.
Yes, on page...
we benefit in the optimal way.
On page 51, for instance, you say that hurricanes substantially increase the chlorophyll concentrations on the continental shelves. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, hurricanes play a role in recycling the nutrients that are critical for advanced life. Hurricanes also play a role acting as a thermostat, because what happens is you get hot water over the tropical oceans, and if that hot water were allowed to remain hot, it would be a real problem for the climate of the planet. But because of hurricanes, it cools all that down. And also, hurricanes play a role in stirring up particulates into the atmosphere, which helps our rainfall content. Notice whenever you get a hurricane, you get lots of rain.
Ah, fascinating. Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. So hurricanes, you would say, are actually important for complex life.
Without hurricanes, things would be a whole lot worse for advanced life.
That is interesting.
What we see on the planet, we have the ideal number and the ideal intensity. That also is true of earthquakes and all the other things we call, quote, natural disasters.
Gotcha.
All right, well, we got to hit a break real quick, but we're going to be right back with Hugh Ross coming up.
And I want to talk about dark matter when we get back.
All right.
This small business tip is brought to you by the UPS Store, where you can help promote your small business and save. Find out how by visiting the upsstore.com/logistics today.
Emails and texts are so 2010. It's time to meet the big three in social media. Facebook is the most visited website of all. Connect with customers through your own Facebook page. LinkedIn is a good way to make business contacts. It's the corporate version of Facebook. And Twitter is the way to stay in touch. Quick posts to bring customers the latest info. I'm ABC's Karen Chase.
Right now, it's the UPS Store 3 for All. Just pick 3 featured products and you'll save 30%. Pick from brochures, calendars, stationery, posters, door hangers, flyers, postcards, and more. And you'll save 30%. The UPS Store 3 for All. Going on now. Offer ends 10-10-11 at participating locations. The UPS Store locations are independently owned and operated. Product services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. Restrictions apply. For a complete list of products eligible for 30% discount and other details, visit facebook.com/theUPSStore.
So check it out. There was this member of our church who was always telling us what to do and how to do it, throwing guilt on us.
Yep.
So
we kicked him out.
That's right.
We kicked out religion.
Revolution Church.
Revolution Church is about building a relationship with Jesus.
And with each other.
And it's about learning who God is. So if you're interested in learning about God and building a relationship with Him, come and join us Saturday night at 7 o'clock. www.salinarevolution.com.
Does your roof need replacing, your house need cleaning, or maybe you're ready to update your kitchen? Big or small, whatever your home improvement need, log on to home.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource with instant access to pre-screened remodelers, maids, handymen, painters, and many other home contractors. It's easy and it's free. Just go to home.servicemagic.com. Home.servicemagic.com. That's home.servicemagic.com.
Truth Revolution.
And welcome back to Truth Revolution, Dave with Jeff and Hugh Ross.
Dr. Hugh Ross, and we are talking about his new book, Hidden Gems in the Book of, or Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. You can check his information out on his website, Reasons to Believe, at reasons.org. You can get his new book on Amazon. And Dr. Ross, can they actually buy your new book on your own website, reasons.org?
Yes, they can.
Okay, so you guys can go to reasons.org and get his book. You can go to Amazon and buy that. I think is it available right now?
It's available right now.
All right, so that's good. Now, we only have a few minutes left in the show, but I just wanted to hit this thing on dark matter. You said in the book that the universe's main component is something called dark matter. What is dark matter?
Well, Job 38:19-20 says, talks about darkness and says, can you take me to its place? Do you know where darkness dwells? And when I read that as a teenager for the first time, it says, wow, I've always been taught that darkness is the absence of light. It seems like Job is saying that it's an actual substance.
Oh, that,
so,
yeah, that's because
that
a lot of people do say that.
Got me over the years. Yeah, well, I mean, that's a textbook definition of darkness. But, you know, a few years ago, astronomers discovered that darkness actually is a real substance. In fact, it takes three different forms, and when you add it all up, it makes up 99.73% of all of physical reality. The stars and galaxies we look at make up only 0.27%. And then if you look at the quantity of the three different kinds of dark stuff, it must be exquisitely fine-tuned. In fact, the quantity and the location of the three different kinds of dark stuff in the universe gives us our most spectacular evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design. And what that told me is that the 50 or 60 questions that God asked Job and his friends in Job 38 and 39 are all designed to point us towards scientific evidences for God's existence and his love and care for us. We can't answer all those questions even today, but the ones we do have good answers for, in every single case, it's given us a powerful new evangelistic tool. And so one of the exhortations I give in the book to scientists is, let's get answers for the rest of the questions.
That is fascinating. Now, just out of curiosity, this is totally off the side here of what you talk about in your book, but is dark matter something that only occurs in the vacuum of space, or is that within here, within, you know, Earth's realm, within our atmosphere? Is dark matter here as well?
Dark energy is a dominant darkness component, and it's everywhere along the space surface of the universe, has the same value everywhere over the space surface of the universe. And there are two different kinds of dark matter. Ordinary matter, which is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, then there's exotic matter made up of particles that don't interact well with light, things like neutrinos and axions.
Ah.
And there's about six times as much exotic matter as is ordinary matter, and without the exotic matter, you can't have stable spiral arms in galaxies, and that's critical for advanced life.
So that would affect our Milky Way galaxy then?
Well, again, it affects the possibility of life. So surrounding our Milky Way galaxy, there is a giant halo of ordinary matter, and it's about 10 times the size of the galaxy that we see. But surrounding that is an even bigger halo of exotic matter. They need both halos of just the right mass and just the right geometric configuration in order to stabilize the spiral structure.
Now, you give on your website, reasons.org, a list of things that are required for complex life to exist. And this list is something like 156 items long. Isn't that right?
Oh, it's actually over 850 now.
850?
850 different characteristics that must be exquisitely fine-tuned to make advanced life possible on the planet. It explains why the astronomical community is reaching a consensus that the entire universe is hostile to advanced light except our pale blue dot.
My goodness.
And yet we need the entire universe in order to have life here on Earth.
They obviously need to rewrite the Drake equation.
No kidding.
They definitely do.
All right. Well, man, thank you so much, Dr. Ross, for being here on the program today. If we could, I'd talk with you for another 3 or 4 hours. But unfortunately, we have to go. Again, if anyone is interested in this book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, you can get it on Amazon or on Dr. Ross's website, reasons.org. And we didn't get into even scratch hardly the surface of what he talks about. He talks about the age of the earth and how we know it's old. And he dispels a lot of myths that go around about him on the internet and things that he believes. So I would encourage everybody to go to his website, get his book, and really understand what it is that he's talking about.
Reasons.org.
Reasons.org.
Okay. And I don't know what we're going to talk about next week to top this, but
I think maybe we'll go back. Instead of astrophysics, we'll talk about archaeology.
Okay.
And we're going to hit, you know, does the Bible line up with history or not?
All right, hitting it old school. Join us for Truth Revolution next week.
And hit us up, truthrevolution.tv.
Get Merrill Teller's exclusive Storm Team 12 forecast on your weather authority. News.